I make some money. We have half of the savings, you thought? I will sit down, balance the books, and account for it all. I'm fairly good with numbers, if you recall. Wait, allow me to double-check one last thing. His father returned his attention to his file of notes, but Sandro plucked it from his grasp. Papa, I'm going to hold on to this folder from now on.
My notes? No, no, no.
His father's eyes flared with dismay.
Son, I need my notes. I'll keep them for you.
As his father stared at him, Sandro realized that he was becoming the head of the household.
Thank you, Sandro,
his mother said, forcing a smile.
Chapter 49. Elisabetta, August 1939. Elisabetta should have been happy, but her chest felt tight. She and Marco headed for the fancy party at Palazzo Braschi, joining the throng of dressed-up couples filing inside. She still felt stunned by what Nonna had told her, that her mother and Marco's father had been in a love affair when Elisabetta was only a baby. She had always suspected that her mother had been unfaithful, but she never would have guessed it had been with Marco's father. Heads turned to admire her and Marco, and she supposed they made an attractive couple, she in her beautiful pink dress and new pumps, and Marco in his dark uniform, his hair shiny, his face tan from the sun. She didn't know if she should tell him about their parents, or even if she should be seeing him at all. Nonna had been firmly against it. But Elisabetta had been hoping to play the evening by ear. She loved Marco's company, and the notion of the party had captivated her too. She had been living the life of a much older person, working all the time, and she had felt so sad after Sandro's rejection. She had to stop longing for him. He was gone. Marco held her hand as they approached the palazzo, entertaining her with animated stories, and when they neared the entrance, he gestured at the elegant facade of Palazzo Braschi, which had been festooned with tricolor sashes and a massive flag with the fascist Littorio emblem.
The decorations are beautiful, aren't they? I helped put them up.
Beautiful.
I'm so glad you came tonight. I've missed you.
Marco flashed his dazzling smile, and Elisabetta found herself wondering if her mother had been as charmed by his father. It made her uncomfortable, and she didn't want to think she was anything like her mother, and she felt suddenly wrong being with him. She had thought she could go through with it, but now she wasn't so sure. Cigarette smoke and heavy perfume filled her nostrils as the partygoers pressed together, bottlenecking at the palazzo entrance. She felt vaguely nauseated.
This will be so much fun, don't you think? My boss is getting a big promotion.
Marco squeezed her hand, looking over, then tilted his head.
Elisabetta, are you okay?
I'm sorry.
Elisabetta let go of Marco's hand, turned around, and made her way back through the packed crowd.
Elisabetta!
Marco hurried after her, but she didn't stop. He reached her in front of the fountain and took her by the arm.
What's the matter? Where are you going?
I have to leave. I can't be with you. I shouldn't have come.
Why? What's going on, cara?
Elisabetta felt the secret bursting within her.
There's something you don't know. Nonna told me something awful about my mother.
I know already.
Marco took her hands gently, and his expression softened.
I know about my father and the affair.
What? How?
Elisabetta felt her face turn hot. She felt exposed and awkward.
It's so embarrassing.
Sit down, please.
Marco pressed her onto the ledge of the fountain, holding one of her hands. I'm so ashamed that she did such a thing.
As am I. I never would have thought it of my father. I'm barely speaking to the man. Nevertheless, what happened between them has nothing to do with us.
What are you talking about? They're our parents.
Exactly. Our parents are not us.
Nonna doesn't think we can be together.
You're your own woman, Elisabetta.
Marco met her eye, his dark gaze unusually steady.
You and I have known each other since we were little. I've loved you that long. I swear it to you now. We are Marco and Elisabetta. That's who we are, and nothing between us has changed.
I don't know. Elisabetta wished she could go along, but her feelings were bollocksed up. How can we be together now? What will your parents say? Your mother? Nonna says it's not practical.
Don't worry so much. Here we are, you and me. We are in the present, not the past. You look stunning in that dress, and we're going to a beautiful party.
A slow grin spread across Marco's face, and his eyes glinted with mischief.
And we're going to dance.
We can't.
Just like this.
Marco encircled her waist with his arm and swept her into the air, spinning her around so that her dress billowed gaily, and Elisabetta felt herself dizzy and laughing, even as he spun her closer to Palazzo Braschi. She saw the fancy people around them as a blur, and she clung to him, wrapping her arms around his neck. And when they reached the entrance, Marco set her down under the archway, where he kissed her softly, chasing her objections away. Marco took Elisabetta onto the glistening parquet floor, guiding her through dance after dance. And she followed his lead, whirling past walls lined with painted friezes, oil portraits, and polished bronze sconces that shed a romantic light. The ballroom was grand, and couples danced to a wonderful orchestra playing in front of a stage under a large tricolor sash strung between two marble columns. Painted murals covered the vaulted ceiling, and the only time they stopped dancing was to accept flutes of bubbly spumante from passing waiters. Elisabetta found herself having fun, and by the third glass of spumante, she began to feel less worried, though she noticed that many of Marco's former friends seemed cool to him. She didn't understand why, nor did she know if Marco had noticed. He focused only on her, making sure she was having a good time. Suddenly, excitement rippled through the crowd, and everyone burst into animated chatter, turning to the ballroom entrance. The orchestra launched into a rousing rendition of Giovinezza as an entourage of black shirts marched into the ballroom, and the partygoers moved quickly aside to admit them. What's happening?
Elisabetta asked, standing on tiptoe. Marco gasped. Il Duce is here. The crowd gave the fascist salute, chanting Duce, Duce, Duce. Marco joined in, and Elisabetta felt stunned at the notion that she was in the same room as such a powerful man. She craned her neck to see him, astonished to find that Mussolini looked just like his image in the photos, posters, stamps, and coins. He had round, dark eyes, a prominent brow, and a strong jawline, a pugnacious visage at odds with his formal attire, a black coat with tails and a shiny top hat. His magnetism was undeniable even to Elisabetta, who was no fascist. The crowd and Marco cheered wildly as Mussolini climbed the steps of the stage to a lectern, surveyed the chanting partygoers,
then motioned for silence as he began to speak.
Ladies and gentlemen, greetings. Tonight we celebrate the promotion of Commendatore Bonacorso, who has served our glorious party.
All of a sudden, the tricolor sash above the stage came undone and began to flutter down, heading for Mussolini. The partygoers gasped. The black shirts shouted a warning, and Mussolini stepped aside just before the sash fell on the lectern. The partygoers burst into astonished chatter, and black shirts leapt to the stage. Mussolini stood aside, and black shirts started calling for a ladder to reattach the sash. There was chaos at the lectern, with everyone running this way and that. The mishap threatened to reduce the momentous occasion to a cartoonishly silly scene.
What an embarrassment for the fascio,
Marco muttered to Elisabetta.
We don't have a ladder tall enough to fix the sash. The contractor took the big ladder with him.
What will they do?
Excuse me, Elisabetta. Be right back.
Marco left her side, made his way to the front of the room, spoke with one of the black shirts, and hurried to the stage. She watched in bewilderment as the partygoers began to notice him, their heads turning. On the stage, Marco hurried to pick up the fallen end of the sash, hustled with it to the base of the tall column, and remarkably began to climb the column as if it were a flagpole, straddling it with his strong arms and legs. Elisabetta's mouth dropped open. The partygoers responded instantaneously, cheering and applauding him. The band struck up a rousing march, and everyone clapped in rhythm as Marco shimmied up the column, climbing until he reached its very top, where he tried to reattach the sash. Everyone looked up, waiting to see if Marco would succeed. Elisabetta marveled at his bravado. The crowd cheered him on. In the next moment, the sash was affixed. Marco signaled that he had done the job, then slid down the column in a controlled manner, landing safely at the bottom. The crowd roared, and so did Elisabetta. Mussolini himself strode to Marco, shook his hand, and spoke to him for a time, then clapped him on the arm. Marco beamed from ear to ear, and the moment galvanized Elisabetta as she knew it was once in a lifetime for him. The crowd hollered and clapped, and Marco was grinning as he left the stage. Black shirts and his friends surged toward him, congratulating him, and Elisabetta realized that he had just fixed whatever had bothered them in a way that only he could. The crowd settled down, and Mussolini retook the lectern, beginning with thanking Marco by name. Marco acknowledged the honor with a nod, then threaded his way through the crowd as Mussolini resumed his speech from where he had left off. Elisabetta didn't hear a word. She felt so full of pride in Marco, who kept his eyes on her even as he made his way through the crowd. Partygoers stopped him, shaking his hand and clapping him on the back, but Marco kept glancing up at her, as if he couldn't wait to return to her side. He reached her, grinning, and she practically leapt into his arms, kissing him. He kissed her back, softly, then deeply, and Elisabetta felt him bringing her broken heart back to life. She felt won over, and the love she had for him rekindled, still there.
Chapter 50. Marco, September 1939. Marco hurried to meet Sandro, catching snippets of conversation from businessmen. They talked in worried groups, and everyone buzzed about the outbreak of war. Hitler had invaded Poland earlier this month, and Europe erupted in conflict and fear. Great Britain and France declared war on Germany, and Romans lived on tenterhooks. Italy had yet to enter the conflict, but Palazzo Braschi was on high alert. Marco had been working around the clock, and there was volatility in the very air. He approached Piazza Bocca della Verità, which was out of the way and contained a small park, unusually quiet and peaceful. The piazza was in one of the oldest parts of the city, just outside the ghetto, and the scale of the ancient buildings allowed for plenty of sunny sky. Only a few people walked by, and traffic was light on Via Luigi Petroselli and Via di Santa Maria in Cosmedin. They spotted Sandro waiting for him on a stone bench, but the sight gave him cause for concern. His friend hunched over a newspaper, reading, but his posture was uncharacteristically stooped, and he looked older in a worn brown jacket and tie. Marco had been worried about him, which was why he'd invited him to meet today. Sandro, Marco called to him. Remember we used to play here? Sandro looked up, then broke into a grin, setting aside the newspaper. Just like the old days, eh? Yes. Marco greeted him, sitting down. We used to get so dizzy running around the temple. He meant the temple of Hercules Victor, a small round building of Greek marble in the piazza, which was surrounded by tall columns holding up a roof of red tile. It's a miracle we didn't get sick. You did? Don't you remember? You threw up. I forgot, Marco chuckled. We spent more time here than at school, and had more fun. Remember, you're talking to a teacher now. Oh, right. Marco looked over, eyeing Sandro with concern. How's it going, brother?
Terrible.
Dimmi tutto.
Tell me everything.
My mother lost her job, and she volunteers as a midwife. My father spends all day at the synagogue. Sandro shook his head. He's helping people, but something's wrong with him. He's not doing well mentally. I think losing the house was too much for him.
Oh, no.
Marco's heart felt heavy. I'm so sorry we didn't get you the exemption. My father is still trying.
Thanks.
Sandro smiled but shook his head.
I don't think it will work, though. My father says they're clamping down. It's so terrible to feel you don't belong where you always have. Now, because I'm Jewish, I'm not Italian. It changes everything.
You'll always be Italian to me. We're the same, you and me. Sandro's lower lip puckered.
No, we aren't. I know that now. I have a new clarity about this, and much else.
What do you mean? We're the same. We always have been.
No, I'm Jewish, and I always have been.
Sandro met his eye evenly.
You think it's the same because you're not in my position. Your life hasn't changed, but mine has. We're not equal according to the fascists.
But not all fascists support the race laws.
Nevertheless, they're responsible for them.
I'm not, Marco said, pained. He felt suddenly aware of his black shirt. I'm not my uniform, and you used to be a fascist too.
I'm not anymore, and neither is my father. He still wants to be, but he was thrown out of his own party.
Marco felt a wrench in his chest, not knowing how to respond, and Sandra's expression softened.
Look, I don't mind being different. I'm proud of my Jewishness. What I want is to be equal, the way I used to be. It's a terrible feeling not to be, and it's with me all the time. Now I feel inferior, less than others, apart, officially.
I understand, Marco said. But he wasn't sure that he really did, or that he could.
You know what's worse? I don't feel safe outside the ghetto anymore. Even here, where we used to play, I'm nervous in my own hometown.
I'm so sorry, truly. You'll always be safe with me.
I know that.
Sandro smiled, but it vanished quickly. But the world has changed with the war.
Do you think we'll enter?
Do you hear anything at work, one way or the other? Marco sighed, for the question plagued him too. All I hear is that Il Duce doesn't think we have the gold reserves for war. He wants Italy to stay neutral. Unless he changes his mind, which he does all the time. How? Marco felt a defensive twinge, having met Il Duce himself. He would never forget that night at the ball, when he had fixed the sash. Mussolini had shaken his hand, thanked him personally, and told him that he was an excellent example of a young Italian fascist. But Marco could never tell that to Sandro. His best friend didn't need another blow, and the fact that Elisabetta had been with him at the ball would hurt Sandro too. He changed his mind with the race laws, didn't he? Mussolini never had a problem with Jews before. That's why my father believed in him, and so did I. He turned on us. It's a rank betrayal. Marco swallowed hard. It was true, and he had to acknowledge as much. You're right, but I don't think he'll change his mind about the war. I dread to think of Italy ever as Hitler's ally. Sandro shuddered. The Nazis are ruthlessly anti-Semitic, violently so. They turned on the German Jews, and rumors are they're attacking Polish Jews. But that won't happen here. I'm worried.
Don't be.
Marco touched his arm. Sandro, what can I do? Can't I help you in any way? No, thanks. But I'm making money these days. If you need any, I can... No. No, we're fine. Sandro straightened up, and Marco changed the subject, not to offend him. How's Rosa? Still in London. Her husband enlisted in the RAF. We get letters from time to time. Sandro bit his lip, his expression newly grave. I hope she's not in harm's way. Italy would be fighting her husband if we enter. But we won't. Again, I hope not, Sandro said, his anxiety plain, and Marco felt a wave of sadness. He would never have foreseen that his and Sandro's teenage years would be concerned with matters of life and death. He fell silent a moment, and so did Sandro, but they understood each other without words, in the way that only old friends can. Let's eat something, Marco said, breaking the spell. I'm starving. I worked through lunch. You want to go somewhere? No, I grabbed something for us, on the street. Marco reached for his rucksack, pulled out a paper bag, and took out a brown bag of supplì, releasing a delicious aroma. Supplì? Sandro frowned, his lips parting. Yes, you like them, don't you? Yes, Sandro answered after a moment. But I'm not hungry.
You sure?
Marco asked, surprised. I got four. No, thanks.
Suit yourself.
Marco popped a supplì into his mouth and bit down, releasing the deliciously salty taste of breading, rice, tomato, and cheese. I have something to tell you about Elisabetta. Sandro paused. My feelings for her have waned. The stronger feelings I used to have for her have gone.
Davvero?
Marco exploded with joy, hugging him. He had been falling more deeply in love with Elisabetta, and it would be wonderful not to have to vie with Sandro for her anymore.
What happened?
I don't know. I fell out of love. Sandro shrugged, but Marco realized what must have happened.
You've met someone else, haven't you? Come on, tell me the truth.
Sandro hesitated, then smiled. Yes, I have.
What great news! What's her name?
Marco felt a wave of happiness for him, because Sandro needed a woman more than he knew. Every man did. Anna.
Where did you meet her?
At school. She just moved here with her family. She's beautiful.
And she likes you back?
Yes.
Bravo, Sandro.
Marco's heart lifted for them both.
So you're out of our competition? You promise?
Yes. Sandro nodded. Elisabetta's yours.
Thank you, friend. Now we both can be happy.
Marco flooded with relief. I lost sleep, worrying she'd choose you. No, Marco. It was always you. Sandro smiled again, a little sadly. I wish you the best with Anna. And I wish you the best with Elisabetta. We're friends forever, Sandro, no matter what. No matter what, Sandro repeated, sealing the bond.
Chapter 51. Elisabetta, October 1939. The late day sun streamed through the lacy curtains in Nonna's bedroom, and Elisabetta entered to check on her. Nonna had fallen ill with bronchitis and lay in bed in her pink-flowered nightgown, covered by a white quilted coverlet. Her bedroom felt cozy, if crowded, containing four mismatched break fronts of china, as well as the conventional bed, ladder-back chair, a pine night table, and a dresser. A ceramic crucifix hung over her headboard, next to a faded photo of the last pope, though Nonna refused to hang any of the present one. She was a Roman Catholic, but considered herself a higher power.
Nonna, how are you feeling?
Elisabetta set a glass of water on her night table.
Don't you remember from the last time you asked?
Elisabetta smoothed down the coverlet, hiding her worry.
Your color is better today. You're improving.
What would you expect? And when can I resume work?
As soon as the doctor says it's permissible.
What does he know?
More than we do.
Elisabetta patted Nonna's arm. If Nonna was cranky, she was feeling more like herself.
Can I get you anything before I go?
Would you please stop asking me questions?
Okay. I'll be home as early as possible.
To plague me?
Yes, exactly.
Elisabetta smiled.
Paolo will look in on you while I'm out.
Where are you going? Why are you so dressed up?
I'm meeting Marco.
Elisabetta had on her pale blue cotton dress with mother-of-pearl buttons, having come home to change after work.
Why?
Nonna's hooded eyes narrowed behind her glasses.
What about his father and your mother?
That doesn't matter,
Elisabetta answered matter-of-factly, not for the first time.
Don't you know you're making a big mistake?
I told you. We're not going to live in the past.
You can't live in the present without acknowledging the past,
Nonna scoffed.
All Romans live in the present and the past at the same time.
Walk by the old Basilica di Santa Maria in Trastevere.
You can't pretend it doesn't exist.
What does that have to do with anything? The church is a building.
So, that only allows you to see it better.
Nonna wagged a knobby finger at her.
If Marco's past were a building, you couldn't deny its presence. Don't you understand my point? How will his father receive you? How will his mother?
Elisabetta didn't want to fuss.
It's not Marco's past, it's his father's.
If you marry him, you marry his family.
Nonna, nobody's talking about marriage yet.
But this is how it begins. Don't you know by now I'm always right?
Nonna, this will be the one time you're wrong. Anyway, I have to go.
Why don't you listen to me?
I do, Nonna. I just don't always obey you. Ciao.
Elisabetta kissed her on the cheek, then petted the cat, sitting at the foot of the bed.
Rico, be a good boy.
When is he not a good boy?
Nonna moved her toe under the covers, playing with him.
He's better than you. He obeys.
No, he doesn't.
Elisabetta left the room with a smile.
Goodbye. He obeys me. Nonna called after her.
Elisabetta and Marco left the restaurant, a local seafood place on the Lungo Tevere Aventino outside the ghetto. The city was still lively at this hour, and couples emerged from restaurants laughing and talking loudly, their conversations lubricated by wine. Elisabetta had sensed, even at Casa Servano, that everyone was trying too hard to have a good time. Romans worried all the time that Europe was at war, anxious that Italy would be drawn into the conflict. The night air was cool, smelling of car exhaust. Elisabetta walked with Marco, feeling happy with him, hand in hand. He looked handsome in a light gray sweater and slacks, like his old self, and the shine on his hair and whiteness of his smile caught the lamplight as they passed.
"So, did you enjoy dinner?" Marco asked with a smile.
"Very much, thank you," Elisabetta answered. They had shared a delicious meal of orata al forno con finocchio, sea bream with fennel, while they told each other stories about their jobs. Marco had done funny impressions of his boss that had made her laugh, charming her.
"You noticed everything about restaurants now? Like a professional?"
Marco smiled again. "Do I?" Elisabetta asked, though she realized he might be right. She felt like a restaurant critic in other restaurants. She found all of them wanting compared to Casa Servano.
"You remarked that the water glass was spotted and the waiter's shirt untucked."
"It was," Elisabetta laughed, and Marco joined her.
"Let's take a walk, okay?"
"Yes, but only a short one. I can't be away from home too long with Nonna unwell."
"How about the Giardino degli Aranci? It's nearby."
"That would be great." Elisabetta liked the Giardino degli Aranci, the orange garden, as it was a park with a natural grove of orange trees, a lesser-known gem of Rome.
"I used to go there at night, after Aldo passed, and look at the view."
Elisabetta heard Marco's voice soften, which she recognized as grief. She squeezed his hand gently. "I'm sorry. It must be so hard for you."
"You too. They say losses are a part of life. But it doesn't make you feel better, does it?"
"No." Elisabetta reflected that he was right. "I'm worried about Nonna being so sick."
"She'll be fine. She's strong. Women like her live forever. And you take wonderful care of her."
Marco paused.
"She doesn't like me, does she?"
"It's not about you. It's about what happened between our parents." Elisabetta thought a moment as they strolled. "How are your parents?"
"My mother is still grieving Aldo, and there are days she doesn't get out of bed. Only Emedio can talk to her."
"I'm sorry."
"We'll get through it. Watch out, cara."
Marco put an arm around Elisabetta protectively as a cyclist whipped around the corner.
"You know, I was in this neighborhood recently with Sandro. We met across from Boca della Verità, like in the old days."
"Oh, how is he?" Elisabetta masked her interest. She wondered if Sandro had told him what had happened between them, then realized he probably hadn't, so as not to hurt Marco's feelings.
"He's busy teaching."
Marco's face fell.
"The race laws are crushing him and his family. I don't think he'll have much time for either of us, for a while."
"I'm sure. Poor Sandro." Elisabetta felt a deep pang. "Doesn't it bother you that the fascists are passing such anti-Semitic laws? It was never like this before. And they're ruining Sandro's family and so many others.
Of course it bothers me. I hate it. But there's nothing I can do.
Marco pursed his lips.
None of my friends at Palazzo Braschi thinks these laws are just. But we lack any say. More and more, we've become afraid to speak out.
Are you afraid?
Honestly, yes.
Marco looked over, his dark eyes searching hers.
But my father and I tried to get Sandro's family an exemption, and we'll keep trying.
I'm glad to hear that, Elisabetta said, feeling a surge of gratitude. She knew that Marco loved Sandro.
Let's head this way.
Marco gestured past the church, off Via di Santa Maria in Cosmedin. They walked uphill along the Clivo di Rocco Savella, a wide cobblestone walkway beside a tall wall, its surface rough with dark stones, bricks, and marble fragments of different sizes. The route steepened because the Giardino degli Aranci was on the Aventine Hill, one of the seven fabled hills of Rome. Elisabetta held on to Marco's hand, negotiating the cobblestones in her fancy shoes. She felt relaxed and happy at his side, marveling at how easy it was to be with him. The breeze was stronger at elevation, carrying the fragrance of the bitter orange trees, naturally perfuming the air. There were fewer people on the street, and cars weren't permitted, so the traffic noises receded into the background. They walked in contented silence, and in time entered the Giardino degli Aranci, a large park full of orange trees and umbrella pines, making a leafy bower against the dark sky. Gaslights shed a gentle light in soft halos, illuminating a light gravel path that divided the garden, which led to a large brick belvedere, a scenic overlook with only a handful of other couples. Elisabetta enjoyed the warmth of his fingers over hers, their footsteps crunching on the gravel path. They reached the terrace and took in the beautiful panorama of Rome at night, bigger and more glittery than Elisabetta had seen it before, even from the balcony at Palazzo Braschi. To her right were the Roman Forum and the ruins, their marble glowing creamy white in the lights from underneath. But her gaze shifted from them to her beloved Trastevere, a humbler patchwork of red tile roofs and church domes across the Tiber, watched over by the serene, glowing dome of St. Peter's Basilica.
"Isn't this magnificent?"
Marco asked her. "Beautiful," Elisabetta breathed in a deep lungful of air.
"I brought you up here for a reason."
Marco put his arm around her, and she tilted her face up, expecting him to kiss her. But instead, he was holding out a diamond ring, twinkling in the ambient light. Elisabetta blinked, shocked. Her heart leapt to her throat. She hadn't seen this coming.
"Elisabetta, I love you, and I've loved you all my life. My feelings have only grown stronger every day. I know I can make you happy."
Marco smiled down at her, his dark eyes shining and his expression intense with emotion.
"I love you. I appreciate you. And I treasure all that is wonderful about you and always have, even from when we were little. I promise to spend the rest of my life making you happy. Nothing would make me happier. I would be the luckiest man in the world if you would accept this ring and say yes to my proposal."
Elisabetta listened, astounded. Other couples were starting to look over, realizing they were witnessing a marriage proposal. They began to gasp, smile, and talk to each other excitedly, as if awaiting her answer with Marco. But she didn't know what to say. She didn't want to hurt Marco or embarrass him, though he didn't notice them. His gaze focused only on her, reflecting the devotion he had always shown her.
Elisabetta, I know you struggle, always on your own, and you don't need to do that anymore. I have a real job and I can provide for you. We can make a family, you and I, and we can withstand all the troubles that the war or hard times or anything else may bring us.
But what about your family? Elisabetta blurted out, stalling. Did you discuss this with them?
No, and I don't have to. My parents will get used to the idea, and if they don't, we'll leave them behind. You and I will live together in our own place, and if they don't like it, that will be their problem, not ours.
Marco dropped to one knee, looking up at her with a heartbreaking smile.
Will you marry me?
Marco, I didn't expect this. Elisabetta watched his expression darken, and she hated to hurt him. She did love him, but she didn't know if she wanted to marry him. Not yet. She was just getting used to seeing him again. She was trying to take care of Nonna and work. She remembered when she had dreamed about becoming a columnist or a novelist. She still had those dreams somewhere inside her, and she wouldn't be able to fulfill them if she decided to get married.
Elisabetta.
Marco kept looking up at her, though a frown popped onto his forehead.
You love me, don't you?
Yes, but I don't know if I feel ready for...
I understand.
Marco looked pained, but his expression remained loving. He rose from his knees, still holding her hands, and pressed the engagement ring into her palm.
I understand. This caught you unawares. We haven't been seeing each other enough. I've been working too hard and haven't given us the time that we deserve.
Yes, that's it, Elisabetta rushed to say, though her heart hurt.
Keep the ring until you're ready. It's only a matter of time.
Are you sure? Elisabetta asked. But when she heard herself, she realized that it wasn't the correct question at all. She was the one who was unsure. She didn't know if it was only a matter of time, and she didn't know if she should take the ring. But it was already in her hand.
When you're ready, just say the word.
Marco kissed her softly. Chapter 52. Rosa, December 1939. It was a sunny, if chilly, day, and Rosa felt relieved to be back on Italian soil. Her heart lifted to see the palm trees lining the Tiber, a sight she had missed in rainy London, and the Thames didn't compare to this river, pea green and sun-kissed. She walked down Lungo Tevere de' Cenci, passing people on the sidewalk, loving the musical sound of her native tongue and noting the emotionality of her countrymen, who gesticulated as they spoke. She hadn't realized how different Italians were until she lived in London, and though she loved David and their circle of British friends, she was happy to be home, even in the circumstances. Rosa had left London on an embassy flight, lucky to get a ticket to Rome, as travel was restricted. David was serving in the RAF, and she had been following the news of the race laws at home, which was systematically stripping Italian Jews of their citizenship, profession, and property. She sensed her parents needed her, even though their letters never said so. Rosa reached the entrance to the ghetto and past the small white church of San Gregorio della Divina Pietà, an ancient church that had significance for Jews, especially poignant now. In the 1500s, the ghetto Jews had been forced to attend Mass there every Sunday as part of the campaign to convert them. The church's ivory facade showed a painting of a crucified Christ above a biblical inscription intended as a tongue-lashing to ghetto Jews. "I have stretched out my hands all day to a rebellious people who walk in a way that is not good, following their own devices, a people who provoke me to my face continually." Rosa looked away, shuddering. She took in Tempio Maggiore, the synagogue directly across the way, its bright lemony limestone a golden hue in the sunshine. The stained glass on its square dome shone multicolored, though she admired the solidity of the edifice itself. And from that structure, she drew strength. Rosa continued down Via del Portico d'Ottavia, shocked by how much the ghetto had deteriorated. Men and women sold used shoes, clothing, and pots and pans from barrows, pushcarts, and stalls. Via del Portico d'Ottavia used to be lined with busy shops, but most of them were closed. People picked through the items, milled about, talked, or even begged. Everyone looked bedraggled in clothes that were old or in need of repair. Gone were the happy, healthy, and boisterous families carrying home full bags of groceries, as well as the delicious aromas of pollo arrosto, roast chicken, and pesce fritto, fried fish, wafting from apartments. Rosa felt oddly as if she had never been here before, and heads began to turn in her direction as she walked by. She realized that she stood out in her fine coat of red wool, with its fashionable peplum waist, matching hat, and brown pumps. She was dressed for London, not the ghetto. She picked up her pace, self-conscious. She passed stall after stall. Then her eye was caught by a set of second-hand books, which tempted her. A woman was bent over unpacking more books. And Rosa glimpsed the woman's gray hair, gathered into a twist that Rosa recognized immediately. She realized with mute shock that the woman was her mother. The books being sold were her own. Rosa froze, horrified. Her mother had aged so much, with new lines etched into her lovely face and brackets deepening around her mouth. She wore her old tan raincoat, but it was stained, and her black leather shoes had flattened with wear. Her mother finished setting up the books for display, opening them so they stood on end, then looked up and spotted Rosa.
"Rosa, is that you? You're back."
Her mother threw open her arms, her eyes filming with happiness behind her wire-rimmed glasses.
"Yes, Mama."
Rosa masked her dismay, set down her suitcase, and embraced her mother.
"I'm so happy to see you." "It's so good to see you too, dear. I've missed you."
Her mother hugged her tightly, and Rosa could feel that she had lost a significant amount of weight. But she concealed her reaction as she released her mother from the embrace.
"I thought I would surprise you. I wasn't sure I could get the flight." "Say hello to everyone. You remember Wanda della Sette di Viroli. And here's Celeste Sermonetta. Everyone, look, my Rosa's home."
Rosa forced a smile as her mother began reintroducing her to everyone, making small talk as if everything were normal. All of the faces looked older, the clothes ragged, and the men who used to work during the day were here. She assumed her neighbors and the parents of her friends had been expelled from their jobs. They had been handymen, teachers, electricians, accountants, shipping agents, scrap dealers, shop owners, tailors, knife sharpeners, shoemakers, and bakers. Rosa remembered she'd left her suitcase on the street. She turned to fetch it, but it was already gone. Rosa sat in her old seat at the wooden table. But other than that, nothing was the same. The apartment was tiny and cramped, the kitchen barely big enough to contain the table. Of course, there was no chandelier, only a glass fixture that cast harsh light. There was a window, but it didn't overlook the charming Piazza Mattei, just a dirty brick wall. Sandro pointed out that the apartment was sunny, making the best of things, though he looked as drained and thin as her parents.
Here, darling.
Her mother set down a serving bowl that was only half full of spaghetti, the tomato sauce thinned with water. There was no other course, no fish, meat, potatoes, or vegetable, nor was there bread or wine. Gone were the delicious meals from better times, the mouth-watering bracciola, or alliciotti con endivia, anchovy and endive casserole served piping hot on platters.
It looks wonderful, Mama.
Rosa exchanged a look with Sandro, who was undoubtedly reading her mind. Her mother doled out small portions, and after her father said a prayer over the meal, they began to eat. Rosa tried not to notice that they gobbled their pasta, truly famished. She ate, noting that her father returned his attention to a thick folder of papers, making notations. He had greeted her happily when he had come home, but since then, he barely lifted his head from the folder.
"So, Papa," Rosa began gently, "how have you been?"
"Fine,"
he answered without looking up, which wasn't like him. He'd always been chatty at the dinner table, but he was completely preoccupied. He was still dressed in his suit and tie, but it had become too large for him, its frayed collar leaving space around his neck. He was balder and grayer, too.
"What's in the folder, Papa? What are you doing?"
Her mother interjected.
"Your father prepares exemptions from the race laws for members of the community."
"Oh, that's good."
Rosa turned to her mother.
"And how are you, Mama?"
"I'm fine, too."
"You must miss the hospital."
"Yes, but I feel needed here. I'm midwife and patch skinned knees."
Her mother smiled briefly.
"The community has come together and we help each other. We barter when we can, goods for services. Someone leaves us food and money in a bag on the door. We think it's one of your father's clients in return for his legal services."
"That's nice."
Rosa knew her savings would do them good.
"Your brother's been teaching mathematics at the Jewish school. He's a born teacher."
Her mother pushed her empty plate away, and Rosa turned to Sandro, feeling a rush of love for him.
"Good for you."
"Thanks. I teach 3 classes of about 40 students each. The ages are all over the lot."
Sandro smiled gamely, but to Rosa's eye, he looked thin too. His cheeks were hollowed out of his handsome face, emphasizing his remarkable blue eyes. But they didn't have their usual brightness, as if hardship had diluted their hue.
"Do you hear from the professor?"
"No."
Rosa felt a pang for him.
"What's going on with your independent study? Do you work on your own?"
"No, I don't have time. I have to prepare lesson plans and grade exams."
Rosa wanted to change the subject, but each one seemed worse than the last.
"How's Marco doing after Aldo's death?"
"He's coming around."
Rosa felt the loss of Aldo, whom she had always liked.
"Poor Maria and Beppe. Emedio, too."
"Marco works for the fascio at Palazzo Braschi.
He and his father tried to help us get an exemption, but they couldn't. Good of them to try.
What about Elisabetta?
Rosa remembered that Sandro had been crazy about Elisabetta.
Whatever happened with you and her?
Marco liked her too, and she chose him. A frown buckled Sandro's forehead, and somehow this struck Rosa as the saddest news of all.
I'm so sorry.
If I have to lose her to somebody, I'm happy it's him.
Rosa could see Sandro was hurt, but putting on a brave face. So, you had your first heartbreak. My advice is to move on. You're a good catch. Are you seeing anyone?
No, I'm too busy.
There's a lot of fish in the sea, Sandro.
Her mother interjected.
That's what I tell him.
Jewish fish, Rosa added, to make Sandro laugh, which it did. I'm glad you're home, Rosa.
Rosa smiled, happy that she had come home too. They needed her, tested in a way they had never been before. Sandro asked,
You must be worried about David, eh?
Yes, of course, Rosa answered, as David was always in her thoughts.
Then we'll worry together.
Sandro reached for her hand.
As a family.
Chapter 53. Marco, February 1940. It was the dead of the night in the ghetto, and a cold drizzle began to fall, so Marco sped up on his bicycle. No one was on the streets, and everyone was asleep, which was why he always ran his secret mission this late. He had been dropping off groceries and money at Sandro's doorstep for months. He would ride to their new apartment, run up to the third floor, hang the bag on their doorknob, then steal away. He and his father didn't want the Simones to know it had come from them, as they would have felt embarrassed. Marco pedaled down Via Catalana, the wide street that ran alongside the front of the synagogue, and his tires bobbled on the cobblestones. The light limestone of the Tempio Maggiore stood out in the darkness, and its square dome rose in a stormy sky. He turned right onto Via del Tempio and rode past the apartment houses, their shutters closed against the chill. A family slept in a door jamb, huddling under a single blanket. Marco looked away. It broke his heart to see the deprivation on the ghetto streets, and he worried the situation was about to get worse. His boss and everyone at Palazzo Braschi believed that Mussolini had changed his mind, and that Italy was going to enter the war on Germany's side. Marco headed home on Lungotevere de' Cenci, and the lights lining its banks were indistinct in the fog. He tilted his head down against the rain. There was little traffic, and he left the ghetto. He never went there in his uniform anymore, even at night. Heads would turn and expressions vary from fright to disgust. He felt awful that the Jews feared the fascists, but he couldn't blame them. He pedaled harder, approaching the Ponte Fabricio. He slept badly these days. He believed in fascism, except for its new anti-Semitism, which tore him up inside. He didn't know what else he could do, except to make sure that the Simones didn't starve. His father felt the same way. It was the only thing they had in common these days, still barely speaking. Marco had almost reached the Ponte Fabricio when he detected a car close to him. He sped up, annoyed. The car sped up too. He glanced over his shoulder to see a dark sedan. He didn't know why it was harassing him. He accelerated again, risky on slick asphalt. The car gunned its engine and passed him, and Marco cursed. Suddenly the car veered in front of him and braked sideways, cutting him off. Marco yelled, shocked. He couldn't brake in time. There wasn't enough space between him and the car. Instinctively, he jerked his handlebars up. His bicycle jumped onto the sidewalk, narrowly missing the car's front grille. He dismounted rather than fall. The bike slid into the stone wall lining the Tiber. "What the hell?" Marco whirled around in fury. The car was a black sedan. He realized it was the type used by Ovra, the secret police. The driver and passenger sprang from the car, their dark silhouettes mere shadows in the gloom. They ran toward him. He recognized the driver's bear-like outline, Stefano. The skinny little one was Carmine.
"You're a piece of shit."
Stefano grabbed Marco by his collar and pinned him to the stone wall. Carmine watched, his hands on his hips. Meanwhile, a bus began to honk its horn, its path blocked by their car. Cars on the Lungo Tevere piled up, unable to pass.
"Get off!"
Marco wrenched away, ripping his shirt. They could kill him right now and get away with it. Ovra operated with impunity.
"Why were you in the ghetto? You're a Jew lover."
"What I do is not your business."
Marco reached for his bike, but Stefano grabbed him again.
"You think we don't know what you're up to? Your lunches with your Jew friend? Your visits at night? There's penalties for fraternizing with Jews. You think the rules don't apply to you? You should die the way your brother did."
Marco exploded in grief and fury. He punched Stefano, and Stefano slugged him back. The two of them started fighting, falling to the pavement. Marco rained a flurry of blows on the bigger man, raging out of control. Stefano hit him harder, grunting. Traffic tangled on the Lungo Tevere, honking. Marco kept punching, ignoring agonizing pain. Carmine shouted to Stefano. Stefano sprang off Marco, leaving him on the pavement. Marco staggered to his feet, doubled over. Blood from his face dripped onto the sidewalk. Rain poured onto his back. Stefano and Carmine jumped into their car, closed the doors, and sped off. Once home, Marco washed his face in the bathroom. His right cheekbone was swelling, and the skin had split. His mother was asleep in bed. And his father stood in the doorway, his arms folded against his naked chest, a formidable figure even in his undershorts. The expression on his face was grave.
"Marco, there were two of them?"
"Carmine and his pet Stefano."
Marco rinsed blood from the sink.
"Stefano used to be an informer. He got kicked up to Ovra. They say he's sadistic."
"Sounds right."
Marco had sensed that Stefano had enjoyed beating him.
"So they've been watching you?"
"Evidently."
Marco turned off the water and patted his face dry gingerly.
"They can go to hell. We can't leave the Simones without help."
"Of course not. I'll feed the entire ghetto to spite them."
Marco looked over, surprised to find his father smiling.
"Are you enjoying this?"
"Absolutely."
His father chuckled.
"There's nothing like a good fight."
Marco smiled, feeling closer to his father. They had a common enemy, rather